What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Black Corporate Life Podcast, where we're breaking the silence and revealing the unwritten rules and hidden truths that govern corporate America. I'm your host, James Friesen. In this groundbreaking series, we're leaving no stone unturned. Join us as we champion authenticity and transparency and bring these topics front and center, one episode at a time. In today's episode, we'll talk about the power of reading the room and trusting your instincts in the workplace. This is an episode you don't want to miss. Our guest today is Tina Taylor, who is the co-founder and general partner of Unum Capital Investments, a financial services investment fund. She's also co-founder for Unum One Foundation, a 501c3 that provides financial education and grant opportunities for minority small businesses globally. Tina also founded the Heritage STEM Camps Foundation, which operates from South Africa to the U.S. and focuses on business and entrepreneurial STEM skills, as well as leadership development experiences for youth around the world. In her previous career, Tina spent a number of years at General Electric, where her last role was Chief Quality and Chief Information Officer for GE Lighting globally. Now, I've known Tina for over 30 years, going all the way back to our days at A&T and General Electric. She's an international public speaker, board member, North Carolina A&T State University alum, Aggie Pride, personal friend, and a real-life example of that black girl magic. Tina, welcome to the show. Tina, what's happening?
Hey, thank you, James, for inviting me to your podcast. I can't believe it's been over 30 years.
Yes, that's all the way back to A&T, mechanical engineering, studying McNair Hall, and then the days we spent at General Electric. It's been a minute.
It has, and you have not changed. But here's one thing that I will say. I'm super thrilled and I'm honored to be seeing you evolve in so many different spaces and driving impact. And every opportunity that I see you in, you win it. And I'm just glad to call you a friend.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I appreciate our friendship
and just being there for each other all these years and for you taking the opportunity and time just to be a guest on the show.
Absolutely.
You got some great experience and I'm really excited about our listeners being able to hear from you. With that in mind, Tina, you could start by telling us a little bit about your career. How did you get to where you are today?
I would be remiss if I just sequestered everything to just talking about the career aspect, because there were so many things that I picked up from my parents that I learned by growing up in Eastern North Carolina that were pillars for how I navigated the corporate space, because I didn't get here alone. There's been so many shoulders that I've stood on. There are people that have opened doors that they unfortunately never had the opportunity to walk through. And quite a few people have built some pathways for me. And again, they never had the opportunity to be able to walk down. And I was one of the first in my family to enter into the corporate space. So there's plenty of ways in which I had to cut my teeth, a lot of corners that I couldn't see around and a lot of things that I didn't know. But let me tell you, there's basic principles that you learned just by being in rural North Carolina. My corporate journey actually started before I entered into the corporate space. I would say two things. One, I think most people know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, the outdoors, that was your classroom, that was your learning lab, you learn about yourself. You could be a doctor, lawyer, engineer, and you practice all of those things by riding your bikes, climbing trees, just by being outside. And also being around the neighborhood kids too. So you get to be judge and jury. You get to practice all of those things. Well, mine actually led to me being 14 years old. I was sitting in the cafeteria of, it was a community college where my mom was a teacher. And I was just there dutifully. I was doing some homework, but I would much rather be doing some other things. But I had to do my homework before my mom finished and we went home. And there were two women that came up to me. And they'd seen me there, and I'd seen them as they were walking past. And they were the directors or leaders for this compensatory education program. So one day, they just stopped and had a conversation with me and asked me what I was doing. And I said I was doing math. And I'm one of these weird kids that I saw math, and I still to this day, I see math in everything. There's always an equation. James, you remember statics and dynamics that we would take for mechanical engineering. I think that was one of the standards that all engineers would have to take. Those things, it came natural to me. And as I was talking to them, they start looking at each other. And they asked me, would I be interested in being one of their teachers? Now, granted, I'm 14 years old, so there's no way that I could get paid. But I was super excited about it. So when my mom finished, they had a conversation with her and my mom, so my dad, and they both agreed. We had to go through this whole process, and I still have it to this day. It was a blue sheet of paper. I don't know if it's like a waiver or permission for me to even be in that classroom. But long and short of it, I started building and developing those skills that my parents had given me and being able to read the room, understanding the environment, having patience and really listening before speaking, because I was a young teacher teaching math in a compensatory education program, which means that you had adult learners. They had learning challenges that you had to teach. And some of them had physical disabilities as well and learning gaps. At 14, that's monumental in learning how, when someone says no or they are interested, how you have to calibrate yourself, how you have to pace yourself, what types of pivots that you have to do immediately to make sure that they can latch on to what they need to gain, those skills that you are trying to convey to them. All of those things out to the corporate space, all throughout going through engineering school and the different positions that I had there to working in that corporate space, it was understanding and learning people, knowing yourself, trusting your gut instinct, and really honing in on your why and your mission. Now, that seems like a lot for a 14-year-old. Fast forward, now you're entering to the corporate space. All of those things are those seeds that I continue to hone in while I entered. And when you and I entered into the space, we came in through these programs. So I was on the technical leadership program. There were 4 6-month rotations, as they would tout. They would get the best and the brightest to come in. And we had specialized training. So we had unique access to top corporate leaders. Every 4 or 6 months, you're working on a business critical objective that you must hit. So again, at 14 years old, I'm in pretty much an adult situation where I'm learning all these soft skills. Now, my first job, coming into the corporate space, now you have to perform. You have to not just have those hard skills. So we used our technical skills, but you had to also hone in those soft skills as well. Once I did that, I actually moved around a bit. Those are 2-year programs, and I was on it for 2.5 years. I ended up leaving GE and started working for another company. And some people ask, okay, well, why did you leave? Again, there was a pivotal moment where my mom was ill at the time. And so I made a decision to be closer to home. But I started working for another company that was closer. And that taught me quite a few things. It was a union facility. So that gives you another set of soft skills. Again, taking it back to what I learned at 14 years old and those basic principles at home. How you have to navigate that space, how you have to negotiate to be able to, again, hit shareholder value. You still have to produce, but people needed to trust you. And that's where you start learning how to treat people the same across the board, but also develop those strategies, both those intrinsic and extrinsic strategies to be able to move your organization or the business along. But interesting about that point, I remember coming home one day. So people said, well, how did you get back to GE? I'm like, well, it's not that I was trying. I'm leading to a story, so just bear with me for a second. So I come home one day, I turn on my answer machine, and it was one of the top senior leaders. And he said, look, here you're doing great things. I want to have a conversation with you about coming back. Long and short of it, had the conversation and I went back. But what does that say? It said that I had built up mentors and sponsors that I didn't know that I had. And it gets back to, look, I raised my hand. I didn't mind doing the tough jobs because that's how I learned and that's how I grew. And it built so many different skill sets. But eventually, yes, I ended up going back to General Electric on the operational side. And fast forward, some of those same leaders, they were also sponsors for me to learn different skill sets by going on the financial services side that ultimately led me back to the industrial side again, which was the last position that I had before I left. Now, there's quite a few things along the way, and I know that there's quite a few questions that you're going to ask me, but I would say there's four things, again, that I took with me. One is learning how to read the room. And when you're reading the room, you have to listen. And that listening, that gives you an opportunity to be able to understand what is being said versus speaking because you want to answer. So you get to pace yourself. With that, your gut instincts, it starts to kick in. Understanding that environment that you're in, you know when to go and when not to go, what opportunity to get into and what opportunity not to take and explore. And I'm going to talk about that in a bit because I did take up some opportunities that probably should not have. But yeah, as one of my mentors would say, just grow where you're planted. God is always going to open a pathway and a door for you to exit, but not until you learn that lesson. And all of those things, they help you with your why and understand what's your business why. Why are you taking on that role, that position, going into that business, that industry? You get to hone all of those things. And then finally, those no's that you get, those are some of the best learning platforms that you can have. Learn and lean into the no, because that's going to be a platform for you to either pivot or for you to progress from. That's kind of my corporate journey. James, I know that we're going to go into some of the questions, but I would tell you, I would not have made it without, of course, people are looking at their careers right now saying, I'm overly worked, I am tired, and it feels as if I'm not going anywhere. And that's where I would say, go back to those four things that I talked about, but I also had to assess that all the time. I had to trust my gut. Does this still feel like the place where I need to be and where I can excel and drive impact? Are the people around me, or are there enough people around me to help me win, help us win? And if not, you don't even need to go to the other two. I think those are hard decisions right there where you need to evaluate, where am I financially? And even if I'm not where I am, you start looking, because it's only going to get worse unless the landscape changes. And what do I mean by that? One of the greatest things that we always talked about was, is my boss going to change or are they going to change me? One of the going things was we rotated very frequently. Every 2 years, you're moving or you're in another position. You're just trying to figure out, well, who's going to outlast or who's going to move first? Those times are not as frequent. And James, as you know, back then, you didn't switch positions or companies that often. Your parents would say, you get in a role, you're going to stay there because they have what? Good benefits. And it was frowned upon if you moved around frequently. You don't have to worry about that today. Almost like a badge of honor for you to have moved around 2, 3, and God forbid if it's 5 years, it's like, wow, you stayed in that position for a long time. The environment for the corporate space today is drastically different than when we came up, and just being able to evolve, but it doesn't change. Understand and know your gut. Do not lose those business and those social intrinsic instincts.
Yeah, I remember because I was at GE for 5 years and decided I wanted to move from engineering and go into brand management marketing. And I remember hearing feedback. You mean to tell me you're going to leave a good paying job
exactly
to go get another degree?
It was unheard of.
Right. That's exactly what I'm going to do.
Yeah. And the fact that we did those things back then, we were considered to be rogue.
Right.
But one of the things I would tell my parents is like, well, but you raised me to be self-sufficient and an independent thinker. I'm going to stress test all of the environments that I'm in. Now, granted, did I do that all the time? No, I didn't. And this is where you can get seduced by a lot of the things that they present to you that keeps you in those positions, in those companies, far longer than you probably should.
Exactly. So just thinking about your career at GE, what was one of the biggest achievements that you had along your journey?
Well, I'm going to say there's two. So I always talked about how I consistently hone my skills and being a corporate leader, reading that room. And a lot of people probably say, well, that's not a skill. Oh, yes, it is. Or they would say, understand or learn how to read the tea leaves. That helps you with negotiations. It helps you to navigate awkward conversations or, more importantly, awkward questions, especially as a minority going into majority spaces. Understanding those skills, seeing how people are shifting or moving when you're pitching, quickly understanding how to pivot a conversation that is going sideways when you're trying to close a deal, or when you're trying to move things on, or when you have to have tough conversations. All those things helps you to recover quickly in delivering your message. That's one of the greatest soft skills that I think, and I learned that one at 14. So you see how those things, they helped me, and I continue to be in spaces and places and had opportunities to be able to hone that. And you just adjust a lot quicker when you know how to do that. Body language is huge. I would say a hard achievement, and there's several, but there's one that I will highlight specifically because it leads us to the digital world in which we're operating today. But I had the opportunity to be a part of what we didn't call at the time, but what we call now a tech startup that was backed by some of the senior leaders working in the company that we were working for. And again, I always talk about cutting your teeth. I had the opportunity to be able to cut my teeth and tap into a space in the early 2000s. So this is like 2002, 2003, that people wouldn't imagine paying for data and access for data. But we started a business called Asset Intelligence. And what was unique about it, this was in a company from a framing standpoint. There was an African-American that was running that business vertical. I reported to an African, and the team of executives that put together what was an idea that turned into a COE, a center of excellence, so it's just all cost, that quickly, within less than 12 months, turned into a viable business. We entered into the market space based on our assets, and then we had to pivot because we saw the profit around it, and we re-entered and started looking at data in a very different way, and that shifted our conversations that we had. And no one thought what we were talking about and what we were doing at that time had value, had financial value. And we saw the significance of it back then. So we started looking at the aggregate of big data. In 2002, when we shifted our market position, we bought the number two competitor in that market. And we sold our product to one of the large big box corporations today, and they were able to get their return on their investments within 6 months. We led that. And that was a team of a lot of African-American people.
You talked about that as being like the kiss or kill initiative that you worked on. Can you talk about what did that mean, kiss or kill?
Yeah, I laugh at that now, but that was one of the greatest lessons that I had. So I don't like to name drop, but it's impossible for me to not talk about this without naming this particular leader who was phenomenal, but unfortunately, he's no longer with us today. And talk about a class act and someone that led with empathy, but was just brilliant and a forward thinker, Art Harper. He brought us into Rome. We were talking about, keep in mind, this was during a time where it was very tumultuous for this particular business vertical, buying, you know, some of our assets at the top of the market at the time. And even if you touched it, you lost a lot of money. So we had to figure out so many different ways and how to take the business from a negative net income to a positive net income. And one of the things in which we worked on was, again, it's the business asset intelligence, but you had three components. You had a transponder, an antenna, and a battery, all manufactured and kitted in different countries and in different places. Before we even got to even talking about those three, we had to figure out what was happening and what was the issue with the transponders. And there was a plan that was laid out to him. He brought us into the room and he said, okay, we're going to kiss or kill this. So we're like, okay, we were just thinking that this was the product or the idea. And it was like, no, it was all of us too. So it's like, okay, that took on a completely different, you had your heart racing, but it didn't have my heart racing for me specifically. I don't know about the others, but it didn't have my heart racing. Oh my God, I'm about to lose a job or not. I'm about to lose this opportunity. I looked at it as I get to work with some brilliant minds to create, co-create, and develop something that nobody else was doing. And that was building a business within a business, within a corporation. And just from a band standpoint, there were quite a few of us that were executives. So it was that it was very few of us within the entire corporation, five of us. So if it killed, we were all gone. We would be repurposed, not necessarily within the company, but potentially outside the company. Or kiss it.
Black Corporate Life is a leadership training and development company focused on empowering Black professionals to thrive in corporate America. We provide classes, coaching, and an online community of like-minded individuals to help Black men and women in corporate America reach their full potential. Join our online community at bclalliance.com.
And it's going to turn into that viable business that it did. We all stayed around and there were other people that came in, and that's why we were able to make the, I would say, those transitional moments, because we had just so many thought leaders coming into the space that enriched it even more. But I can tell you this, with Art being a forward thinker, and it's something that I think not a lot of people appreciated then, more people are talking about it now from a leadership perspective. He led with empathy. He saw the good in people, but he also had those tough conversations as well. Again, the kiss or kill, you know? That was going to be all of us. But we wanted to make him proud. We wanted to make the business proud. And last but not least, we wanted to make ourselves proud. And I learned so much about myself. One, I learned, again, the 14-year-old Tina that was in that program grew into, now I'm in this other unique environment where I'm actually driving change and value. That is not just for a moment, not just for another revenue line item, but it was going to actually change the world. We wanted to make sure that we did this well. But what did that mean? It meant having a lot of no's, confronting conversations where people didn't think that. I mean, I still remember it as if it happened yesterday. We had a great pitch, talked about the direction that we were going in, seeking additional funding. So talk about being entrepreneurial and being in a kind of like a tech startup, but just had the backing and I didn't have to worry about a check. I was getting a check every 2 weeks. So that was a great learning experience. But you can see the path and the horizon of where this is going to go. And you having people to say, no, no one is going to buy data. No one is going to buy services based on data. It was all heavily asset driven. This was in 2002, 2003. He put his neck on the line for us, and we just said, so it didn't make me feel as if I was going to lose anything. It was a win-win all around, and we were working 18, 20, literally 20-hour days, flying here, flying there. We were going to make sure this was going to be a success, and it was.
So you were the original Big Data, the OBD. You kicked off the industry before it became what it is today.
I would like to say we were one of the few groups out there that was doing that.
Gotcha. So when you think about, for a lot of Black professionals, one of the things that we look forward to is reporting to another Black leader. Very excited about that opportunity, but it doesn't always turn out to be what you expect going in. How was your experience?
That's a very interesting question. And you do hear a lot of people talking about that. we know that we're going to be some of the first going into that space, and we're going to overprotect sometimes in making sure that we're, as they say, look, don't mess up, right? And it's a tremendous burden, and it's a burden that is a reality. Is it fair? No, it's not fair, but it is reality. I would say from my experience, James, I probably had a very unique experience. I had not one, not two, but I had three phenomenal leaders that I reported to. I named one. That was Art Harper. Thomas Canditti was another. Wayne Hewitt was the other. So those are three pretty senior leaders that was within the company. And each one of them created a pathway, opened doors, but also had those tough conversations with me where I'm like, I feel like I'm disappointed. And, but they had empathy. And this is what I said back then, empathy is not something that people rallied around. Today, we talk about empathetic leadership. We talk about being transparent as a leader. They were before their times, but I think it was because they saw how hard I was working. They also understood the tapestry of how the corporate environment is made up. And you don't see that many of us. They're going to pour into those that are really going after. And I was trying to go after. I really was. Let me be clear about that. I wasn't trying to go after the big title, the big jobs. I was going after the learning experience because that's what my parents taught me. My father taught me, when you take on a job, know everything about it. My mother went into spaces, learn everything, talk to as many people as possible. And by those basic principles, you're going to stand out, so to speak, or people are going to look at, this is somebody that is either coachable, somebody that I want to invest in, somebody that I want to lean into. And those three people did that.
There's extra pressure that you carry with you, that extra burden of knowing that as a Black woman executive in the company, that no matter what you do, you're going to be judged harsher than your peers. You know, is that old saying that we always say to each other, and I've experienced it myself in my career, when you get in certain roles, you get certain opportunities, you cannot mess up. Because not only will you mess it up for yourself, but folks are watching you and they will judge everybody else that looks like you if they should happen to come into that same opportunity. So how did you manage carrying that burden around?
I think that's a very interesting question, James. And this is what I would say. There's a taxation that comes with every minority leader that comes into a space. And how I describe it to people, I say there's a bullseye when you're entering in. You constantly are getting hit. Even out the gate, you're just starting. And then as you start to gain more responsibility, as they say, climbing that corporate ladder, that bullseye gets bigger and bigger. So that means that you're getting quadruple the hits. But you're not just protecting yourself, you're also protecting your team too. Because people like to not just punch you, they want to punch in. And it's like, no, you're not going to do that with my team. If anything, I would throw the punch down. So how do you manage that? A couple of things that I had to do, and I didn't do it well. And there's a pivotal moment that I'll talk about in just a second. But having those mentors, that certainly helps. To finding those coach partners or peers, you have to be careful about some of the peers. But there are people within the organization, they are truly going through something very similar. Within that corporation, we had the African-American form. So we had some affinity groups. And there were even subsets to that where you had outlets to be able to talk about. You had some people that you can talk about how to navigate certain spaces. And again, it gets back to me honing those skills from that 14-year-old that was in that compensatory education program. It's like, okay, trust your gut. What is this saying? I'm an engineer, dissected everything, and re-engineered solutions that was going to be, again, I'm better for what I thought, better for the company, better for the organization, better for me and the team. I constantly designed and sometimes over-designed things, but I certainly had those outlets, and I tried to take as much time as I possibly could to decompress. But when that light switches on, it's very difficult to turn it off. James, I can say I probably managed it on a high alert until I left.
Wow. So just a follow-up two-part question for you. As you think about your career and climbing the corporate ladder, what did that earn you? And the second part of that is, what did it cost you?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. So I would say, as you're leaning into any position that you have, you know, there's great insight that you get in perspective, like global insights in running businesses, how you make decisions, because it's not always a black or white. So having the opportunity to work with some fantastic leaders around the world, having amazing teams from around the globe reporting into you, and they're expanding and helping you to grow, learning business processes, understanding profit and loss. So all of those business aspects you get, you also get that human side as well in being able to grow and develop talent. And again, perfecting your why, your narrative around going into different markets or having to justify your budgets. Those are all of the great things that I rely on now, even as an angel investor and a social impact investor. I look at those things now that gave me a lot. What did it cost me? This is a very interesting question, because more so now than what we talked about in the past, we talk about mental health and taking care of your body and being able to pace yourself. I'm very driven. I have a type A personality. I want to excel. I want to exceed. If it's going to take someone 10 hours to do something, I want to try to cut that into 5. But it may take me 30 hours to figure out and unpack and redesign and do, you know, you would go through all of that stuff. How do you re-engineer everything? And again, at the end of the day, you want to make yourself proud as well as your community proud. But I worked myself so hard. I remember I was traveling a lot. Not going to say location of where I was, but I was traveling, not getting enough rest. Stress level is high, is heightened. And I passed out in my shower. And let me set this up, because I think a lot of people now, when we're talking about overwork, being stressed, and here's the thing, I was overworked and I was stressed for doing good, because I loved what I was doing. That's the kicker. My stress was, okay, how can I amp it up more and more and more? You just go, go, go. And to some point I said, am I addicted to travel? Am I addicted to working hard to the detriment of my body? And I heard someone say before, you can't build and drive change overnight. It does take time and it takes a team of people. And two is, don't burn the temple when you're trying to drive the change for what the temple is going to sit on. And that's people. So I've always been about, how do I drive impact and how do I drive shareholder value? And what led to that was me not taking care of my temple, me not taking those breaks. So that's why I think when you asked that other question, I was thinking about that. And it's like, well, where was the calibration? There was no calibration. There was none. But there was also part of the environment too. It was also part of the expectation. And as people are listening to this, I constantly say, listen to your body, be perceptive around your environment. Look at what the environment is saying, the code of work and the work output, what that is. Does it match where you are in your life at that time? Now, I would tell you, from that happening, so two things happened. One, I passed out. I was like, oh my God, okay, well, what is this? I literally thought I dislocated my shoulder. And again, type A, I drove myself to the emergency room. Now, mind you, I'm on the phone with my sister because it was so surreal. Obviously, I can laugh about it now and I hope everybody laughs about it, but everybody's going to have some moment in their life, whether you're working yourself so hard, you know, people have hit walls. That's going to happen. But I was talking to my sister as I'm getting dressed and I'm going to take myself to the hospital. And of course, she and my brother-in-law, they were like, no, you need to call 911. I said, no, I feel fine. So I went there, and fast forward, the conversation that I had with the physicians, and this was an actual university teaching hospital, which was great. But they said, Ms. Taylor, your red blood levels are low. I was suffering from extreme exhaustion, but again, you're plowing through it. It's mind over matter. And it's the pressure of driving excellence in everything that you're doing. But they said, you need to slow down. Now, I just had a long haul flight, so it's going to mess with your body to some degree. To take another long haul flight, I was on the heels of that. I was scheduled. This happened on a Saturday morning, and I was scheduled. And I had just gotten in that Friday night from a long haul flight. And I was leaving out again that Sunday. I didn't leave out that Sunday, but I did leave on Wednesday. But I took a vacation, and me and several of my friends, we went to Spain. So this leads to my second pivotal moment, which I talk about. There, our first day getting in, so technically it was the second day because we got in that night, but we were in the southern part of Spain, took a tour that next day to the Rock of Gibraltar, which is owned by the British. And I had been to Mallorca before, but I saw these majestic mountains plain with these clouds hovering over it. It was just calling me. So I'm talking to the guy. Now, if anybody's been on the Rock of Gibraltar, you know there's monkeys that's hopping everywhere. Quite distracting, but real cute. So I actually had one on my shoulder when I was looking around. And I asked the guy, I was like, okay, what is that? And he looked at me all indignant. He was like, oh, that's Africa. There was something about him saying that that just shifted me. I didn't know I was that close. And I said, I want to go. He was like, oh, well, you know, we had that. I said, I don't think you understand me. Change my itinerary. I want to go tomorrow. What is the quickest way? Okay, Ms. Taylor. Well, I was staying in Malaga at the time, and we got up at 3 o'clock in the morning that next day. We got on the ferry, which was the fastest boat. It was 14 miles from the tip of the southern part of Spain to Tangier, to Morocco. And we took speedboat. Yes, speedboat is 45. That was the quickest. And I wanted to get there the day that I saw it. Let me tell you what happened in that. Everything that I have talked about at the beginning of this podcast, my childhood, growing up, being African-American, there was always this underlying element of who am I? Inherently, I know who I am, the person in which my parents birthed and just had all this zeal for life. And to be a life learner, but also a hard worker. But there are some fundamental things that I think most African Americans don't face and understand or get to know until your feet hit the soil on that continent. And then all truths come forward. So I constantly talk about reading the room, understanding your gut and your instincts. These are things that you have to learn over time, but these are all survival skills. When my feet hit the soil of Africa, there was a reverberation that happened in me that changed the course of everything that I was going to do going forward. And that was a pivotal moment for me in looking at, one, I had just passed out. How am I calibrated? Who am I working for? What am I doing? And who am I doing this for? Now, granted, it took me 10 years to actually act on it, all those things that I had learned. From passing out, making sure that I'm taking care of myself, I'm listening to my body, I am taking those vacations. I mean, you have 6 and 8 weeks of vacation and you take two, that's unheard of. That's unheard of. To now, you're feeling a sense of pride, purpose, and quite frankly, the lies that have been told to you about your dark skin or about your hair. You see the beauty of that landscape and that tapestry. And I just said, I feel like I'm home. America is where I was born, but Africa is my birthright. And whatever I'm going to do once I step into the entrepreneurial space or the investment, I will start there first and let that ripple effect happen and be in reverse. And that's what I've been doing since then. So it cost me a bruised shoulder. It cost me like questioning. And just to let people know, this is called vestibular syncope. I had never heard of that before. And they said this is very common. It was a trifecta of having a low blood count, being overly exhausted. I was exhausted, but I was dehydrated. And the other was my body temperature had risen to a level that pretty much it flatlined me. But as soon as you fall, you reboot. I can't think of any other word, but you reboot. And there's quite a few athletes that have had this and other people that have gone through it. But regardless of what happened to me, I think anyone that is killing yourself literally and driving so hard on a consistent basis, do you have calibration in your life? Because it's not equal. It's never going to be balanced. There's going to be some trade-offs. And I was just riding high hard for a long time. And I needed to rethink some things that took me, again, 10 years to act on. And that was once I left building my boarding school in Africa, starting my not-for-profit that's focused on women and girls as well as minorities. So I lead, I learn, and I drive impact in those areas. But now is squarely looking at, on this other side of 50, is squarely looking at how do I take and leverage all of the lessons that I've learned along the way and drive financial and social impact for people globally.
What a powerful story. Two quick questions for you. One is, what are you doing now?
So it's what I hit left with. So I am the general partner for Uno Capital Investments. And I have two not-for-profits. One is Heritage Stem Cancer Foundation that I started in South Africa in 2016. And I have the other foundation, which Heritage is going to roll up under, which is the Uno One Foundation. And all of that is providing financial modeling, financial services, financial inclusion for minority small businesses globally in the ag space.
Got you. And then the second question I'll ask you in just a second. Tina, I want to thank you for bringing the fire today. We talked about fire. I ain't talking about F-I-R-E. I'm talking about F-I-Y-A, fire. You brought the fire today. I just wanted to sum up key three lessons that Tina shared with us. Number one, you really need to learn how to read the room. Body language is important to be able to read it, to interpret it, and use it to your advantage. Number two, understand your why. Why are you working for a particular employer? Why are you doing the job that you're doing and who you're doing it for? It's really important to have answers to those questions. And number three, be sure to trust your instinct, trust your gut. It took me a long time in my career to actually learn that lesson, but it's very important to get that early. Tina, I want to toss it back to you with one more question, and that is this. Who did it better, Michael Jackson or Prince?
Both.
Both. And the question is why?
You said two quick questions. Now you're throwing in a third. You know what? I love them both for different things. My favorite, considering I know people can't see what I have on, but I have on purple. So purple is royalty.
Gotcha.
Prince it is.
Gotcha.
But you're asking why. He just did everything. You know what I liked about him that ties back to the Black Corporate podcast? And I think they both had it. They just exercised it differently. They understood themselves. But Prince had an acute awareness around business. He had a strong business mind. He understood how his industry processed money, made money, and how he created money for that, which is the reason why he took the actions that he did. And everyone that was within his orbit, he taught them all about that process. He taught them about business. So who did it better? Prince.
Yes. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. But Tina, again, thank you so much for joining us as a guest on the show. You shared some incredible insights for our listeners today, and we hope to have you back one day as a guest in the future.
Thank you, James, so much. And again, congratulations on creating this safe space for us to be able to share our experiences with this next generation that's coming and taking the reins.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Have a good day. Black Corporate Life is a leadership training and development company focused on empowering Black professionals to thrive in corporate America. We provide classes, coaching, and an online community of like-minded individuals to help Black men and women in corporate America reach their full potential. Subscribe to our podcast by visiting blackcorporatelife.com or search wherever you listen to podcasts. And join the Black Corporate Life Alliance at bclalliance.com.